You're listening to the Bethel University Chapel Podcast, recorded from the Everest Ward Chapel Fine Arts Center in Mishawaka, Indiana. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be with you again like this. And don't you appreciate our worship teams that have helped us all semester? Why don't we let them know that? We appreciate that. Them lending their skill to us. I'm only with you up here a couple of times a year, so it's always a good chance for me to give you a few updates, what's happening at your school, and so after that, I'll have a message to share with you to wrap up our semester. Let me show you a couple of things on the screen going on. Our projects around campus usually rotate the major projects every 2 years between student spaces, academic spaces, some administrative things. So in that rotation, some of you have seen what's going on there by the admissions area. It's Welcome Center. We've had, fortunately, a lot of more traffic over the last few years visiting families, so this will be a place to host them. There's another picture here. There'll be seating for about 30. One thing I'd want to show to you, you see the top left is a conference room. You'd want to know that we're going to name that for Dr. Deb Gillum to honor her. Some of you nursing students in particular would know about her, but our School of Nursing during her leadership tenure has achieved a top 10 national ranking, among other things. And so it's a way to honor her. That'll be named for her. There's one more picture here. Just gives you a sense of how that'll be used there. So that's what's coming. And then also another project that's going to come. Let's look at the next slide. You heard about this, I think maybe just before Thanksgiving, very briefly in Bethel News, but we'll be doing a training center. You know the land that goes south to Jefferson? There are a couple of athletic fields there. So this will go on that space. And this will support some sports, but also general student population for fitness and some rooms, actually, you could use for any purpose. So look at the next slide there. You see something's gotten jumbled up there. It's been inverted somehow. Anyway, top of the bottom left says classroom. It's actually going to be a community room. So say you wanted to have a space to celebrate somebody's birthday or maybe even private exercise in there. Also, a large floor space for exercise, Zumba, things like that, and fitness equipment as well. This also heals a wound, kind of. When we do satisfaction surveys with you, you've told us, too many of you that we're comfortable with have said you're not really very comfortable, don't really like the fitness spaces that we have. So this is an answer to that. Just wanted to point that out. And also, a mezzanine area, space to gather 30, 40 people up above there. So anyway, that's coming. We hope to start that in the spring. And then another thing that is coming is, I'll invite Chris Hess to come up, please. But in fall of 2020, we're going to start an esports team. I don't know if you know much about that. I'm one of those middle-aged guys that's had to catch up on that. But here's what's going on, is about 90% of teenagers are gamers. And there are about 200 million enthusiasts in e-gaming. There are only about 2 or 3% of colleges that have teams, but we thought we'd get in on the front end of that. Part of the reason we're able to do that is because we have a facility partner. There's a picture here. If you go, okay, yeah, so the Bendix Theater in South Bend, about 10 minutes away, the Century Center, currently looks like that. It's used for weekend events, gatherings, but it'll be converted to this. Let's look at the next picture. This will be an esports arena, $2 million esports arena. Video ribbon boards are on the top. Teams will compete in the lower level, and we will have a Bethel team space there in a separate room for a team, and also lots of stations for a club that might want to compete as well. Overwatch, League of Legends, some of these kind of things. I think I have one more picture. Okay, that's that. But this is Chris Hess. Many of you know him. He's been a longtime leader on our campus, and he's the administrative head for this process. So some of you, I can tell by the rumble, you're talking about it. Some of you might want to be interested to play or be on our team. You'll represent Bethel against teams all across the country, certainly our Crossroads Athletic League. And so if you want more information, Chris Hess is your contact. Okay, yeah, thank you. All right, and another change that's coming is we're going to modify our dance policy beginning in January when you come back. We know that dancing is not needed for fun on a campus. You can make your own fun, and we know that not all forms of dance are immoral. I've got two daughters who went through their Christian college, and when they went to the dances on their Christian college campus, they told me, "Dad, it was gross." So, you know, there's ways of doing it that is not really the style we're looking for. But we're not going from no forms of dance to all forms. You might know we have already had choreography style through theater and cheerleading routines. We've already had dancing through coursework, tap, ballet, jazz. We've already had like Zumba exercise style dance, things like that. So we're just going to expand that in the fun and moral category. And so I invited a couple of folks up to just to describe what the first couple ones will be. I think Anna will talk first.
Hi, guys. So we're really excited about this change, and the way we want to celebrate it is in February, we want to have a stepping event. So more information will come out for that starting the next semester. But just, yeah, look out for that. And then for the future, like if you're interested in like hosting something or you want more information, I work for Student Life, and that would be the office to go to if you want more information or if you want to organize something. So come talk to me or anybody in Student Life, and they can give you some more information on it if you want to have that.
Student Council is also going to be hosting a dance next semester on January 17th. This will be the Bethel Snowball Semi-Formal. We're really excited to be hosting this, and so if you're interested in coming, we'll have more information coming out soon, and especially after Christmas, but keep in mind it will be semi-formal for clothes you might want to bring back after the semester break.
Okay. All right, thanks. So that's happening. Thank you. And a last update before we bring a message for the chapel is we're going to have some Bethel University insignia license plates. You might have known we've had Bethel College for years. This might not be important to you. I don't know if it is or not, but actually here's how it works. You might not know, through the sale of personalized license plate, if you're an Indiana resident, and about 70% of our students are, a portion of the funds to produce those comes back to us. So we've actually raised $32,000 of student scholarship money through the purchase of these license plates for your cars. And what we found is, that so figure $3,000 or $4,000 a year just through this. What we found is when students have a financial stress in their lives, that it's pretty rare that people have a $5,000, $8,000, $10,000 problem. A lot of time it's a $500 problem, $700 problem. So this process has actually gotten right back into saving some students to remain with Bethel, several students per year. So if you are involved in that process, either your parents' car or your own car, whether you're a student now or when you graduate, if you're going to renew a license plate, you can do that, and part of that comes back to Bethel, okay? All right, so those are the updates. What I'd like to do now is talk with you about a message, a passage of Scripture, and at the end of this, we're going to have a surprise. I hope you find it meaningful, Christmas gift to somebody in here, but I'd like to talk about some Scripture and the reason why before we get there. The theme here is the justice of Jesus. We're in that turn from Thanksgiving to Christmas, and images come. When I say Christmas, what do you see? I see a baby in a manger. When I say Thanksgiving, what do you see? I see angry Brits who have packed their bags and they're speed walking to a boat to get out of Dodge. It's amazing what happened there in Thanksgiving. How unjust do your circumstances have to be to want to leave your home, your job, everything that's familiar to you? And how audacious it was of them. When they got on the boat, they were going to a land they'd heard of but don't know much about. Probably many of them had never even sailed before. An interesting part of history is the cartographers, the map makers, when they didn't know what the charted territory would be, on the edge of the map, they would write, "Here be dragons." So the audacity of these people feeling this peak injustice, a loss of religious liberty for them, a heavy taxation for them, not enough representation in government. They felt this extraordinary injustice to actually leave their home. It's sort of a cycle between an outcry of injustice inspires courage to act. Well, we know that story so well, it can almost feel like a fiction. Like, who would do that today? But actually, there are things going on in our world that are unjust and that would inspire people to act. Let me give you one example that everybody in this room could relate to. You can feel the injustice of it. Right now in the state of Michigan, just a few miles away across the border, there are students at Christian colleges, just like Bethel, that are going to lose all of their state financial aid because the governor line item vetoed all of the public money going to students, specifically if they were attending a private college or university. If you're attending a public or state college, you still get it. And when you look at that, it feels unjust. Literally, there will be students who cannot continue next semester at their Christian college or university because of this line item veto. And so it inspires courage. They're lobbying. They're trying to. Spring Arbor University, for example, I've talked with the president, there'll be $1.5 million taken away from their students. It's unjust. But the question is today, what in the world does the baby in the manger have to do with that? As we're celebrating the birth of Jesus, his life and his message, certainly his primary message is that our souls would find peace with God and be saved for heaven, but it's more than that. In Romans 8, we learned that right now, Jesus sits at the right hand of the Father, constantly interceding for us. He's looking at the status of our world. He's whispering in the ear of the Father and saying, we've got to do something about this to bring justice. What is in the heart and the mind, what words are coming from the mouth of the baby Jesus today in heaven? And there are times where we see that answered in the scripture that was prophesied long ago. So Isaiah 42:3, I have it on the screen. Isaiah said this would be one of the purposes of Jesus. He will not falter or be discouraged until he establishes, that should say, justice on earth. The book of Matthew confirms this prophecy was about Jesus. Today, Jesus is interceding in heaven for unjust circumstances. What is this justice of Jesus? Injustice is easier to demand than to define, but we know it and we feel it when it happens. When you were treated unfairly and are not receiving your due, it needs to be set right again. Or when groups of people experience recurring unfair disadvantages, it needs to be set right again. Certainly, there are calls to justice echoing through our society, even in the church, that are detached really from the core mission of Jesus. Liberation theology, for example, is preoccupied, so preoccupied with legislative and economic systems for revolution, more talk is about Marxism than about the transformative potential of a life change by Jesus in a person that can change a society. Also, the message of the church can get hijacked by social justice warriors who are putting more energy into shaming privilege than cultivating personal piety and getting changed through the transformative life of Jesus on a person. The thing really driving justice of Jesus isn't some kind of intellectual assent to some abstract theory. It's not really driven by a devotion to some sort of broad cultural design system. It's not really even about lobbying for some vague social value like just being nice or being compassionate. Ron Sider, who is a professor of theology and public policy at Palmer Seminary, says in his book, Just Politics, that the ultimate foundation of our obligation to justice is that God is just and wants our society to be just. So you see it all over Scripture. In Isaiah 61, I, the Lord, love justice. You see in 2 Chronicles 19 that we are God's agents to assure justice on earth. I'll give you the scripture, but when you hear it, don't just think about an address to kings or presidents. Think also about professors or student leaders or administrators, anybody in a seat of judgment. It says, quote, consider carefully what you do because you are not judging for mere mortals. You are judging for the Lord who is with you when you form a verdict. Judge carefully, the scripture says, for with the Lord our God there is no injustice, end quote. We also know there are some projects of justice that are closer to the heart of God than others. There are literally hundreds of scriptures that talk about God's special compassion for certain categories of people who have been disadvantaged, the widow, the orphan, the poor, the oppressed. The oppressed, by definition, refers to someone or groups of people that have come into hardship by unjust actions by authorities. So Jesus in Luke 4 announced his identity in part to say, I am anointed to preach good news to the poor. In Deuteronomy 10, it tells us that God executes justice for the fatherless and the widow. He loves the foreigner, the alien, the sojourner, and he gives them food and clothing. In fact, God so closely identifies his purpose through us with the poor that in Proverbs 14, it says, quote, whoever oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker. It's not that God hates the rich. He just hates unjust gain in wealth on the backs of mistreating other people. And so when God gives special attention to the poor or the widow, the orphan, the oppressed, and he's calling us to do that too, he's not showing bias against people who are stable. He's showing a fondness for people who are suffering. It's sort of like this. A firefighter is not going to show equal attention to all houses. He or she is going to go to the one that's burning and give their energy to the one in trouble. Or in a household, if you have several children and two of them are doing well academically and one is struggling, it's just that the parent would give more attention, more tutoring attention to the one that's struggling. So God is showing a fondness to some people without biasing others. I think this is why the scripture says that God takes up the cause of the weak. And he showed this by putting some structural solutions into the Israelite community. Let me just give you a few examples. When the Israelites were in slavery under Pharaoh of Egypt, that singular person owned all of the land. There are other countries nearby where it was a little different. It was a feudal system, landlording, where a few people owned the land, but most people didn't. But when God established the Israelite people, his nation through which his plan would be enacted, what did he do? He gave land through the promised land to 12 tribes. Every tribe had their own land. And within that, the families in the tribe had their own land. It was a distributive system. It was a way that even though larger tribes had more land and smaller tribes had more land, it was a way that God established equal opportunity for land ownership. But to protect that further, another solution that God designed was if poverty forced someone to sell their land, the kinsman redeemer system meant a relative had the right or even responsibility to purchase the land back to keep it in the family so it wouldn't be lost. Or if over multiple generations land ownership came into dispute, the year of Jubilee meant that every 50 years the land must be returned to the original owners. Even with the poor, the instruction to landowners who were growing crops was, leave the corners or the edges of your field for the poor, that they might come along and pick the crop to eat, or if grapes are being plucked, pick up whatever has fallen, that they might have a way to eat. But that was a civic society. It was a theocracy that we don't have today. They were civil instructions for a particular people in a particular time. You know, what does it have to do with us? Well, modern Christians really need to pick up the moral content of those laws to live it out today. And even talking about the moral pulse of social justice in the church can get really sticky if we're relying upon principally law or funding as the primary mechanism to achieve it. Actually, law and morality are very different projects. Law can restrain evil, but it's not going to neutralize it. Law can promote the common good, but that good gets contaminated by sin so that the good is never fully realized. Christians will never legislate enough of the faith into regulations because we live in a nation committed to pluralism. Thankfully, we're not in a secular society. I remember years ago when I traveled to the country of Turkey, I visited a college there. They have a secular society, and they prohibited any women from wearing hijabs, clothing that connoted Islam. They wanted to exclude all religious influence, secular. But we are a pluralistic society. It's different. The premise of a pluralistic society is that religion influence is good. The challenge for us is our laws protect different convictions at the same time. And so the laws we have can only ever be a proximate activity for an insoluble diversity. It is an insoluble diversity, ultimately, in our culture and land. Because to love and promote freedom of speech and freedom of thought and freedom of conviction and conscience, it's great. But it also means that people with different convictions are going to collide with our beliefs, obviously, to do so often publicly, and it brings a lot of angst to any witness to that. Even in the rare cases where the legal agendas align, and even the moral purpose behind it, like wanting to have access for everyone to food, housing, education, healthcare, all of that costs public money, a lot of public money. It costs so much, not all of it can be funded. Even in America, which is the wealthiest and freest nation in history, we can't fully fund all that people demand as rights. They kind of become hopes that we prescribe, but we can't fulfill what our heart desires through a system. And so this can get kind of depressing. Our nation, our state, even Bethel, cannot fulfill a justice mission by mere policy or budgets. This is why the justice of Jesus is a lot deeper than that. To put it most directly, God delivers justice through people more than policies, through behavior more than budgets, and through someone's initiative more than institutional initiatives. Frankly, it's on you and me. And you see it in Jesus, the way he always took an abstract external law and tried to make it internal. You remember his preaching, the Sermon on the Mount, where he said, you know, the law says you shouldn't murder, but if you hate someone in your heart, you're guilty of that law. Or he'd say, the law says you shouldn't commit adultery, but if you lust after someone in your heart, you've committed, you're guilty of that law as well. He was always putting it inside and not relying on an external law. And so what are we going to do when rights collide or all the morally driven purposes can't be externally funded? How might the justice of Jesus be executed through us? Here are three ways that every one of us can participate in the justice of Jesus on our campus, in our homes, our communities. Here's one. Make sure we're paying attention to fair standards. Jesus watches for justice in us when we apply standards evenly or not. Think about the agreements you make with one another, even informally. Promises or pledges. Sometimes you sign formal contracts for things. Well, in Proverbs 16, it says the scales and balances of commerce belong to the Lord. Leviticus 19, don't use dishonest standards when measuring the length of things or the quantity, for I am the Lord your God. I think in our life, it shows up like this. What happens to a student who discovers their grade is lower than a peer while appearing to meet the same criteria? That's unjust by unfair standard. Or what happens in a campus club or a team when a couple of members don't abide by the campus lifestyle covenant and are not disciplined while others uphold that covenant? That's unjust. The standards are not applied well. A second area where we can participate in it is fair process. Jesus watches for justice in our processes. For example, in Exodus 23, do not deny justice to the poor during lawsuits. It's not saying they can't be sued. There's a process there that needs to be fair. Don't accept bribes. This is why transparency is a very high Christian value. Giving due process to people and being unbiased and honest and visible in all of your conflict. So, for example, what happens when a Hispanic person who discovers he was not invited for a job interview while a white person was given the job and they had the same credentials? This is unjust by unfair process. Or what happens to a student or a professor or administrator who's publicly criticized but was never confronted personally by their accuser? It's injustice by unfair process. Third and last example I have for you is fair opportunity. Jesus watches for justice in how goods and services and opportunity are divided. Do people have fair access to education and housing and food, a job? This project is not really about creating equal outcomes, not guaranteeing equal outcomes, but equal opportunity. In fact, sometimes unequal outcomes are just and fair when they can be attributed to rewarding someone for unusually hard work or rewarding them for a rare talent, for example, or their risk. For example, we have a very strong pre-med program. Our students do very well going to med school. They're doubling the admission rate of the national norm, and we have lots of physicians in our alumni. Well, you know they're paid very well. What are they doing? Even right now, we have med students who are applying for med school. They are taking on massive amounts of debt, and they're losing income during the years while they're studying. So that when they're done, they're making a lot of money, unequal to the rest of us, but also in the way that they develop an industry, getting a lot of patients around them, 6 or 8 or 10 other people get jobs because they've had that specialty. So in that case, it's just that there's unequal outcomes, but was there equal access to begin the process if someone wanted to choose it? But there are also some Christian values for opportunity justice that you just rescue somebody. Somebody who's come into traumatic, hopeless circumstances. It's kind of like how Jesus said, I will leave the 99 sheep who are just doing fine to rescue that one who's in trouble. So sometimes it's right for us to look for that person and just rescue them. This might be obvious to you, but maybe you've never thought about it. Do you know that everybody sitting in this room doesn't pay the same for your Bethel education? Sometimes I'm on a flight. It's like that too. I paid $300. The person sitting next to me paid $275. The person over here paid $500. Well, why is that? Why isn't it all the same? Because we give merit-based scholarships that reward rare talent and unusually hard work for people in academics or the arts or athletics, things like that. But we also give need-based scholarships before their great outcomes are even discovered. The student who receives the least financial aid at Bethel comes from a really wealthy home, has mediocre grades, and kind of doesn't have a co-curricular talent that they're involved in. They get the least. The person who gets the most financial aid comes from a comparatively impoverished home, have really good grades, and they have some kind of rare talent that they're improving our climate with. And so you see in that, there's a way of showing fondness for some people who have disadvantage without showing bias against the others. Well, I want to conclude now. We're talking about the justice of Jesus and how our community should receive that and work that through into our life. Imagine a university community which doesn't wait for a policy or a program, but participates personally in applying fair standards, fair processes, and creating fair opportunity for other people. Imagine a university community showing fondness for those who are under bitter hardship. We would be in the agenda of Jesus if we are executing that, because we know what the scripture says in Isaiah, he will never falter, he will never grow discouraged in bringing justice to earth. We would be in his agenda doing that. So I want to charge you in three ways, and then I'll be finished. The first is, I hope that you let this elevate your standards and your process in your dealings with people. I remember just a couple of years ago, there was a student who was in the bookstore. She picked something off the rack. It was labeled in such a way that she could afford it. But she realized all of the other items on the rack were much higher in their price, though they're the same item. It was obviously a mismarked item. And so she took it to the clerk and said, I can afford this and I want this, but it's obviously not the right price, so you should just fix that. She didn't manipulate the system. That was the justice of Jesus in fair dealing. Well, we found out, and so we wanted to bless her. We got her that clothing, and then we gave her a lot of cash because we love rewarding people for integrity. Second, would you let the justice of Jesus inform your prayer life? When you experience injustice, it can be maddening. It can make you so angry you can't even pray. And I think I've learned a secret of the Christian life, that God will delay his response to us because it builds holiness in us. I know that God is not only a moral God trying to make us moral people, but he's a holy God making us holy people. And the scripture says, without holiness, no one can see the Lord. And so this declaration of the heart and mind of Jesus for justice becomes something you can pray about. You could pray that, Lord, I have difficult circumstances. It feels unfair. But I know you've said that you will never grow tired, never be discouraged in bringing justice to earth. Do you see me, Father? Remember your promise to me. These are the areas where I need your work in my life. And whenever you're praying the scripture, you're going to be pretty close to praying the will of God. The last thing is that I hope that this justice of Jesus is so much in your mind and heart that it influences your own good deeds. I would hope that you would not wait for some agenda that comes from an RA or from a professor or something like that. I would hope that you would just go ahead and meet someone's social need or a tangible need that they can't meet on their own. And we'd like to do that today.
Thanks for listening to the Bethel University Chapel Podcast. Subscribe to the podcast and get more information at chapel.betheluniversity.edu or check us out on the iTunes Store by searching for Bethel University Chapel.